Hi, everybody. My name is Casey Crane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I, too, am glad to be here and glad to be alive and sober. It's a little bright up here, but that's all right. I could be outside, staring at the sun or something a few years ago. Anyway, that's another whole story, I guess. It's nice to see this room full of people. I was originally scheduled to talk at 10 a.m. this morning, and Sharon and I just got in here about 50 minutes ago, I guess, and our friend Chris, who was originally scheduled to speak at 3, spoke at 10 a.m., and we got sober within a few days of each other in the same home group in 1982. I've been sober since November 28th, 1982, and everything past 5 months was a new world record for me. I'm very eternally grateful for every minute of sobriety. If I somehow checked out later on today, for which I'm not volunteering, I would have had the best 23 years and a half of my existence. And I've been sober now longer than I drank, whatever that means. But apparently I like it. And sobriety is fun. I love sobriety. If sobriety wasn't fun and we were out there beating on a tambourine and begging strangers for money, I think I would have been gone a long time ago. Alcoholics Anonymous is fun. And for those of you that are new, I'm really essentially here to talk to you. And although there's nobody who braved standing up for having less than 30 days, I identify with that. I never did either. And all you had to do in my home group was raise your hand, and I thought, they're not getting anything out of me. I'm here. I'm going to monitor the course until I see evidence that something's happening. And I literally knew that I would drink again, and I knew that I would die from being drunk, and I knew that there was no other way. And what I didn't know was that that's what I needed to know to be surrendered, to the point where I could hear something other than my own choo-choo train of thoughts that was racing on down the line. I have found a home in Alcoholics Anonymous. That concept did not appeal to me until a few years ago when I ran across a quote from the poet Robert Frost, who said, "Home is that place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in." And I thought, yeah, okay. And for those of you that are new, if you are alcoholic and you believe you're alcoholic and you raise your hand when they call for alcoholics in meeting, you're here, and we're not going to throw you out. And you can hang in here until you get sober and enjoy going to meetings, or you can, toddle on down the line. I've seen a lot of people come and go, and a lot of people don't make it. And I'm not really sure what the reason for that is, but we're the lucky ones. The people that are in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that are sober through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the steps and traditions, are the lucky winning minority of all of the alcoholics in the world. If there's 2 million alcoholics in the world, or 2.5 million, you're going to get to know a lot of them. I come here and I know Dick and Peg, and I know Dory, and I know Bob up here on the dais. I didn't know that they were going to be here, and I know Marilyn and Susan from Eugene, Oregon, and I know some other people that are in this room that I haven't laid eyes on yet, but I know you're out there, and it's a big world, and you have access to the entire world. We as sober alcoholics can go anywhere and find meetings and fit right in, and you'll run into people that are sober wherever you go. I thought it was interesting that we celebrated somebody's anniversary earlier. I've been married for 60, actually, I was going to say 61 days. It's actually 2 months and 1 day. Yesterday was our 2-month anniversary. We went out to dinner and yeah. And It's great. You can't slap the smile off our faces. We're happy to be married. One of the benefits of sobriety. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I came from a good family. I had nice parents. They were bright people. I was born in Huntington, Long Island, New York. There was no crazy abuse going on around our house, or no screaming at midnight. I was the oldest of what turned out to be three children that my parents had, and we moved around from Long Island to upstate New York to Western Pennsylvania, where I went to high school, and then I went off to college and had my first drink at Penn State. Somebody shoved a can of beer in my hand. It was Schaefer's of Philadelphia. The beer to have if you're having more than one was their jingle, and and I always knew I would drink. My earliest memories of people drinking was not people in bars being sloppy drunk. It was my granddad was an illustrious publisher and lawyer in New York, and he had a place out on the South Shore of Long Island, and people came out there that were powerful people. They were opinion shapers and people that were in the Eisenhower administration and people that had made it in their field. And at 5 o'clock, when they opened that liquor cabinet and somebody rang a little bell, the rich and powerful would gather around and have their martinis and Manhattans. And I thought, this is a strange ritual. You know, they just broke up the good croquet game that was going. But I always knew that when I was old enough, I would drink, because that's what people did that were, that had success, that were adults. And of course, I don't know that they started with two cans of Schaefer's of Philadelphia. I should have read that label more carefully. You know, if you down these two beers, will this set up an insatiable craving for which there will be no known cure for the next 21 plus years, and this will lead you through, you know, the valley of ashes. And if so, drink up, you know. Otherwise, flee. But it didn't say that. I remember the room I was in. I remember where I sat in that room. I remember the other people that were in that room. And it's funny what you remember. This was a long time ago, 1961. And I wasn't a good drinker initially. I got rubber-legged bombed on two cans of beer, and I staggered back to my dorm room and passed out. And when I woke up, I realized if I was ever going to fit into this world at all, where I had never fit in, I was going to have to learn how to drink. As a kid, I had had polio. It was before the salt vaccine. I was crippled. My legs didn't work. I had to be carried everywhere. I didn't have a wheelchair. My parents were well off enough that I was carried around. And I was waited on hand and foot. And I learned to be by myself. I became desocialized. I was not allowed to be in a room where there were other children, ever. And even my younger brother and sister. And, you know, I was not aware until I got sober that this probably had an effect on me, you know. And I'm sure it was devastating to my parents. I never thought of that, you know. I just thought, just keep bringing me the flounder and pancake diet. Slide it under the door, you know. I don't need you. All I need is the radio and comic books and books. And my solution to my problem then as a kid was to retreat into a world of books. I read a book every day that wasn't a school book cover to cover. I immersed myself in a world of fiction. And I started to think of myself as not a real person. I was either above or below what real people were, but I was like a fictional character. And when I learned how to drink, when I got into training with drinking and learned how to drink, I became the equivalent of a fictional character, in that I was heroic, I was saintly, I was always right. I had all of those grandiose things that the protagonist of a novel would have. And of course, you know, because I was the hero of the story, everybody else was window dressing. You know, everybody else was just cannon fodder. And not a good combination of a way to think. So I had, even though I had had polio, I became captain of the track team, and I was good at some of those things. And at Penn State, if you had asked me, why am I here, I would have said, I'm here to run the mile. If you asked my parents, they'd say, so he can be, you know, self-supporting through his own contributions or something like that. But shortly after I began to drink, though, I ran a mile in 4 minutes and 7 seconds in practice. And one of the assistant coaches came up to me and said, keep up the good work. We know you're going to break the four-minute mile. You're going to be the youngest person in history to have done that, and we know you can do it. Attaboy. And I remember what I thought when he told me that. I thought, he knows I can do it. I know I can do it. Everybody I run against knows I can do it. I don't have to do it. I'm done. And at the end of that season, I never ran competitively again because everybody knew I could do it. What the hell, you know. Running around in circles, what for? You know. But by then, you know, those Schaefer beers had begun to do their work, and my hair grew a little longer. My pimples started to fall off. You know, I found out that if I brought sorority girls to happy hour at the Rathskeller, I could drink for free. Who the hell needs this running around in circles business? And that's the way I started running my life. It's whenever I got close to achieving something of some importance or success or any productivity, I would, you know, retreat. I would find another way. And the way that I found always had alcohol in it. When I came to any fork in the road, I took the one that had alcohol on it. And that began to be, little by little, the dominant force in my life, unbeknownst to me. And unbeknownst to anybody, I guess. And at Penn State, too, during the wintertime, it gets very cold. You could go to a drugstore if you had a cough or bronchitis and get this stuff in little brown bottles called turpinhydrate and codeine. You'd sign your name. Now I'm sure they have to run a credit check on you and fill out forms in triplicate or something. But back then, you could sign your name, so I went around to all of the pharmacies in State College because I'm the kind of person that wants to manipulate and control all of the things in my life that I can manipulate and control. I was began to be like that a long time ago, and then I got everybody on my dorm floor to go to all of the pharmacies in State College, the ones I could talk into it, and I could be very convincing. I don't know why that is either, but... And pretty soon I could throw away a whole drawer of my linen cabinet, and it was filled with little brown bottles of turpinhydrate and codeine, 40% alcohol with a big jolt of codeine in there. And it was a good way to start the day. You know, if you had that little tickle, you know, you might get a cold, you might get the bronchitis. It was preventative, really, and that was my thinking. And right before they could kick me out, I said... I'm leaving anyway. You can't kick me out. You can't fire me. I quit. It's one of our theme songs. And I bounced around a little more, and I wound up in Youngstown, Ohio. It was the dreaded 60s were about to kick off, and I was in a place known as Bomb Town or Little Chicago. It had nothing to do with me, but somebody handed me a stick of weed, boo or reefer, we called it then, and I smoked it, and I didn't have that much to drink that night. I'd been discovered some new strange thing, some stinky old weed, and the next day when I woke up, nothing on me hurt too bad except for my cheeks from cramping up so hard from laughing the night before, and I probably smoked that little giggle weed every day for the next decade, no big deal, and I tried to corner the supply of that just like I did with the turpinhydrate and codeine, And I met a lot of people that I had never known existed before, except people that I read about in books. And I set up little arrangements with the Italian mafia, the Lebanese mafia, a variety of biker gangs, the Laguna Brotherhood, the Black Panthers, and a bunch of other people that wouldn't normally mix. And I was good at it. I was a good organizer, and I loved, because I was a shy bookworm and wanted to be in the background. I loved to be around people that were very demonstrative and dramatic and crazy and violent and all of that. And it was great. It was like being in the middle of a crazy book. And of course, I was bulletproof, so I couldn't get hurt, and I was, you know, immune to the consequences of my own actions. You don't need a hell of a lot more than that, and some things are going to start going haywire. And I had a friend. I had friends that nobody else would talk to. I knew this guy that had a $200 a day heroin habit. Even the outlaw bikers didn't care to talk to him, and he was an outlaw biker also. But to me, he was an interesting character, and he had great stories. And he came up to me one day, and he said, "Casey, man, your friends and I, we've been talking. We're worried about you, dude. You're an alky. You're a juicer. You're a grape. You're gonna grow up to be like our parents." And I thought, is that really so bad, Stoney? You know, is that? What do you want me to do? Yeah, get myself a motorcycle and start robbing places like you do, and running that white powder. I'm happy. You know, I'm healthy. I'm happy. I'm flushed. I'm crazed. I'm right where I need to be. And don't bring it up again. And I, you know, back in those days, I probably over the years knew about 50 chicks named Sunshine, and one of the girls named Sunshine was annoyed with me, and she said, "You know, when you die, and it probably won't be long, I'm going to have you cremated and sell your ashes for $50 a spoon, because frankly, you're worth more dead than alive." And it's kind of a backhanded compliment, really. $50 was a lot for anything then, and I tried to take it in the best way possible. But, you know, the point is that these aren't people that worked in the field or had some vested interest in a better world. These are people that are hanging out over the edge, too, and they're noticing that something is wrong with the way that I drink, that I turn into somebody else, that I go through that profound personality change. And to me, that's what I'm looking for. That's what I want. And they don't get it. And maybe they get it a little too well, but they're throwing up some warning signs along my road of happy destiny. And my solution to them is, you're excommunicated. You're out of my life. You know, I don't need that. I'll find some people that understand me. You know, and I'll head on down the line. And I piled a bunch of people in a car one day, and we headed for the left coast from Youngstown, Ohio, and got there in no time flat because we were wide awake, and bumped into the Pacific Ocean, and we remembered then, aha, we got a friend living over here on North Vermont Avenue named Mad Dog. And so now Mad Dog's got three new roommates, and eventually a couple more migrated west. And in his one room, $75 a month roach farm that he had over there, and it seemed like that was the point of the whole place, was to raise cucarachas. And I'll tell you how infested it was. There was an old Murphy bed in the wall, the kind of bed that goes up into the wall, and a little pull thing. And we had orders never, ever, ever pull down that Murphy bed. So, of course, as soon as everybody was gone one day, I thought, aha. And I pulled the thing down, and you couldn't even see the wall. There were so many cucarachas there. So I started giving them names and numbers and, you know. And it's like I always like to go to sleep with something to drink by the old bedside, in this case, by the old floor side. And occasionally when I would get up in the morning, I would have a live cucaracha in my first drink of the day. So you go, look, look. Just like Johnny Ockerlund spitting out the pimento, I guess. He was a little more high end, I guess. And this is when everything was going great. You know, I mean, I was young, I was strong, I was healthy. You know, I was, you know, on the verge of being a world class athlete, and now I'm, you know, a world class a-hole, I guess. But we're always down at the Sunset Strip, down at Barney's and the Whiskey and the Rain Check Room and all those funky dives down there. And a lot of your famous dead rock and roll stars were still ambulatory, and some of them were friends and acquaintances of mine, and we were having a heck of a good time. It was late 60s now, early 70s came along, and everything's going swimmingly until my good friend Mad Dog got stabbed in the heart by his hooker girlfriend, and that was a bad day. I was standing a few feet away and pulled that steak knife out of his chest, and that was a mistake because he started to bleed a lot. And so we piled him in the back of a Karmann Ghia, and it was Saturday night on the Sunset Strip, and I'm driving this Karmann Ghia on the Sunset Boulevard on the sidewalk because the traffic wouldn't move fast enough. And we got him to the hospital, which unfortunately was connected to a police station right next door, and they cut his clothes off him and saved his life by the skin of his teeth. And he told me later that the last thing he heard him say in the ambulance was the guy in the back said, "Hey, you may as well slow down. This guy ain't going to make it," right before he passed out from loss of blood. But, you know, that's the price you pay in this lightning-fast life that we were involved in. You know, we're trying to change the world one person at a time, and I had a whole bunch of philosophical hoo-ha that I was spouting at midnight in the dark in the corner in the back at whatever bar I happened to be in. And in a brilliant alcoholic move, though, I moved in with the Stabbers' two best girlfriends, who turned out to be semi-professional party girls, and we got things pretty well organized and had a lovely Spanish-style home just off the Sunset Strip, and no visible means of support whatsoever, and life was good again. And of course, this was really started to get really nuts. I had this entourage of crazed people that were hanging around with me, and I knew some mob guys from the East Coast that had a variety of contraband that they didn't know how to move exactly, and I figured it out for them. And and now we've got people running in and out of the house of all hours of the day and night, and my semi-pro girlfriends, who were semi-pro means sometimes they remembered to charge at parties and sometimes they forgot, and I was there to remind them what the goal was, and saving for our retirement, and just all kinds of crazy business. One of my clientele was a mailman who was saving the credit cards that were coming to people that came in the mail and giving them directly to me in lieu of cash, so my girlfriends and I could go on these lightning shopping sprees. And we were, if you're going to go on a shopping spree, you rent a car because you don't want anybody writing down any license plate numbers. And then once you've got the car and the little spree is over, you don't have to get that car back right away because it's not in your name anyway. So now I have another problem is out in front of my pad in West Hollywood. I've got a fleet of overdue rent-a-cars and... you don't know what to do with them, you know. Drive them 300 yards away and walk back? No, that's not a good idea. And my solution was, if any of you were there and you were leaving a party that was pretty much nonstop at our place and you were so rubber-legged bombed you could barely walk, I'd say, "You shouldn't be walking. You should drive. Why don't you take one of these cars and leave it somewhere and don't tell them where you got it?" Now, this house of cards had a lot of little shenanigans going on all around it, and people were getting hurt, and people were getting arrested, and a lot of it was fun, but there was a tab to be picked up for all of that. And a friend of mine who'd been overseas came back to the United States and found where I was living and knocked on the door one day and came in and told me that he had a better plan for his future and that I could join him if I wanted to. He said, "What I'm going to do," and he said, "I suggest you do this too because, you know, you're playing Mahatma Gandhi with this band of snaggletooth morons isn't going to work out for a whole lot longer. We should join the Merchant Marine and then we can smuggle jewels and drugs from the South Sea Islands and retire to Costa Rica and live like kings." And I said, "Now you're talking. Why didn't I think of that? Who are these people in my living room anyway, and what do they want?" And so we rocketed out of town and left all of that behind, all that mess behind, and tried to join the Merchant Marine in San Francisco and Portland and Seattle. And they were already fill up with skinny, long-haired, pale smugglers with a plan, you know. I'd like to meet somebody sometime that actually did join and had their plan even work a little bit, because I know there were plenty of them around, and it wasn't an original idea, I don't believe. But you know, what you need to know about that scene is, as much fun as it was, and as much as some of you would have liked to have been there, and I would have been happy to have you there, the people that were there didn't really survive very well. And one of the women did not make it to the age of 36, and the other one didn't make it to the age of 26 as a direct result of alcohol and drug abuse. And I don't know what happened to the other people, you know. I live in Los Angeles. What happened to all of my zany friends, I can only wish the best for them. But we were on a road that didn't have a lot of future to it, and it didn't have a lot of survivability. And interestingly enough, Sharon, whose talk you'll hear later on tonight at 6 o'clock, knew those women that I lived with, and I never met her when I was out there. And I knew a couple of the guys that she traveled cross country with who were writing a book, and I knew those guys and shot pool with them and drank with them, but we never met each other when we were out there. We met each other in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad we did not meet earlier. That would have been bad. I think so. I wound up living in an abandoned train station in Chicago, and I went back to Youngstown, Ohio, and one day I bought a bottle of Red Ripple wine with my last dollar, and I drew up 2 cc's of red wine in a syringe, and I shot it into my arm, because, as my first sponsor said, apparently you're not a social drinker. And and my teeth were starting to fall out, and bad things were happening. And, you know, the once bright guy is now being pointed out as, you know, the like a poster boy for, you know, vegetables. And things are not going well. And I come back to California and get arrested in rapid succession 3 times in 5 weeks for drunk driving. And this introduces me to the court system and diversion programs and judges and cops and all of that stuff. And even AA and NA, which I was sentenced to go to 3 different times for 1 year each, and I failed to fulfill the terms of my probation each time, which got me in more trouble with the police and all of that. And I was beginning to hit bottom, and I didn't know what was happening. I just knew that bad things were happening, and I didn't know exactly why. And I wanted to do something about it, so I checked into a detox in Long Beach. And it was a hospital, Long Beach Memorial. And they had a 7-day program, and they did a blood test at 7 days, and they said, "You're still, you know, you got a lot of cigarette butts and empty beer cans floating around in your bloodstream here. We're going to have to send you off to Rancho Los Amigos in Downey." And I spent another month there in Downey at the largest rehab hospital in the world, rehab there. And this was my first detox of 14 and my first rehab of 5, because I wasn't a quick study. I wanted to hang on to that thing that had brought me so far, that one thing that made life on earth tenable for somebody like me, that made it possible for me to sit in a room by myself and be comfortable, much less be around anybody else. I had to have fresh alcohol in my system, and I knew that. I knew it intuitively, and I knew it in every way. And I was psychologically and physically addicted to alcohol, and I kept trying to get away from it, and it wasn't going to work. And I broke into a friend's house one day, and he called the cops after he called some friends, and I punched his friends, and I punched the cops, and they dragged me back to jail again, and they sent me off to Camarillo State Hospital, which was the state hospital up the coast a few miles north of Los Angeles, and they kept me there for 10 weeks. And I graduated. I have a diploma that says I graduated from Camarillo State Hospital, and about 8 years into sobriety, when I was marketing director of an electronics company, I had it framed and put it on my office wall. And the president of the company came in and said, "Get that off the wall. What if a client sees that? It ought to give them hope." Look how well I'm doing. So, you know, the prognosis wasn't good, and I got out of there, and I, this is on wheels. Pretty exciting. After they took away my driver's license, they took away my license to ride a bicycle in Santa Monica. You had to have a license to ride a bike, and then they started arresting me for drunk walking and drunk sleeping in people's lawns, and the last time I remember getting arrested that's worth recalling is the time I fell asleep on this nice dewy lawn on about 19th Street in the Regent Park section of Santa Monica, a very ritzy neighborhood. I'd been kicked out of a party at gunpoint. You know, I know when to leave. I can take a hint. When a hair trigger 38 is pointed at my forehead, it's like, adios. And I couldn't make it as far as I needed to make it, so I laid down to take a nice cool nap at about 5 a.m., and the sun was up when I woke up, and I heard tires screeching to the curb, and I woke up, and that big, awful, bright light was on, and I see the police getting out of the car and shaking the dew off me, and one of the cops turned out to be Officer Byrd, who had arrested me before a couple of times, and he said, "Oh, look, it's Casey. Get in the car, Casey. You know the drill." And I thought, I was a track star. They'll never take me alive. And so I get up and I start running, and you know how when you first wake up and you got a blinding hangover, and you don't run real good, and you don't even stand up very well, but in this case, I rocketed into a hedge. I thought there was this crack that I could get through, but it was an illusion, and that illusion went on and on. And I got tangled up in the hedge, and the hedge went inside my clothing, and the cops came across the lawn, and they could barely get the cuffs on. They're laughing so hard, and And Officer Byrd came off with this classic line. He said, "Look at this, the master criminal captured by vegetation." And I thought, look at me now, Ma, top of the world, you know. It's like, what can happen now? And so I'd been court-ordered to AA off and on for years, and mostly on, but I was mostly off, and so now I went back with a vengeance, and I went back to meetings, and they wanted me to get a sponsor, and I knew a bunch of people, and the word, I guess, had gotten around that I was back, and I had that surrendered deer on the highway look, because I realized that I was, as I mentioned at the beginning, that I was going to die drunk, and there was nothing anybody could do about it. And Chuck C. and all of the great speakers of that day could come and stand at the foot of my bunk and give me their best stuff, and it wouldn't make a darn bit of difference, because I'd read that book. You know, the magic words were gone, and I knew that it was over for me. And that's the point I needed to reach, because then I was surrendered enough to do what I was asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was an important day for me to get to. And it was years into sobriety when I realized actually what had happened. And if you're new, you don't have to understand why you're here. You know, why are you the alcoholic when you're the best one in the whole clan? You know, why are you here when, you know, there's so many really bad people out there in the world, and you know, you have to go to AA and get a court card signed or whatever you've got to do. You know, the pressure's on from significant others and employers and all of that. But for me, people had given up on me a long time ago. Nobody wanted to see me around, period. And You know, I wasn't even allowed on my aunt's property for about 3 years into sobriety because of the stunts I pulled before when I was supposedly recovering. And so I went home and I spread all these phone numbers out on the floor, and I thought, one guy's a planner for that little Mattel toy company down there in Hawthorne, and they make the Barbie doll and the Malibu Ken, and maybe if I ask him to be my sponsor and he's a planner for this company, I can get him to make a Crazy Casey doll, and then I'll, when I die drunk in a few months, I'll be immortalized in plastic. And that was my plan, and that was my reason for asking him to be my sponsor. And it kind of worked in an odd way, because when I told him about the Crazy Casey doll, he just said, you know, keep coming back. Keep some of these ideas to yourself. He said, I'm keeping a book of all your best ideas here, and I call my friends at night and regale them with your best thinking. But in the meantime, you know, pray some, go to a meeting every day, get commitments at these meetings, and call me every morning after you brush your teeth, and I'll tell you what to do next. You know, and I did that because I was surrendered. But along the road of Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety, I've sponsored a number of men, and I'm very happy to have done that. And some of them are very creative, and one of them was a script writer, among other things, and he's also had a lot of artistic talent. And he wound up, for my 15th AA birthday, made a very professional-looking Crazy Casey doll in a professional graphics box that looks exactly like something you'd see on a shelf, except that the Crazy Casey doll, you would never buy it, because it's got a little syringe, a little jug of wine, a little Camarillo banner, and it looks like a kind of a Jules Pfeiffer cartoon under electric shock treatment. And the graphics on the box has a knife-wielding hooker and a PO'd rent-a-car guy and all of that. But it's great, and I still have it in our storage area, and if you drop by, I'll show it to you. But I can't even look at it. It gives me the willies, you know. It's like, kind of got to watch what you asked for around here. You know? You just might get it. And anyway, my life in sobriety began, and my sponsor wanted me to do all of those things I just mentioned, and he wanted me to develop a habit of prayer. And he said, the best way to develop a habit is to do it every day. And in order to, for you to start developing this habit, tomorrow morning I want you to ask on your knees for, say, please keep me sober today. And that night, tomorrow night, I want you to say, thank you for keeping me sober today. I want you to say please in the morning and thank you at night. And don't make it too elaborate. Keep it simple, because I know you and you'll just get off on a tangent. And so I thought, I need a really cool higher power, and I'm strolling on the beach unemployed at about 6 months of sobriety. And I came up with the really cool higher power, and I ran up to him at Ohio Street, and I said, Keith, I got it. It's the ocean man. It's really covers three quarters of the earth. It's controlled by the moon. It's got the tides. It's coming in. It's going out. It's nice and calm on the surface, but underneath, the big ones are eating the little ones. A vicious fight for survival. And he said, whoa. He said, if you recall, I wanted you to say please in the morning and thank you at night. But if you have to have pictures of sharp-toothed fish in your head while you do that, knock yourself out, you newcomer knucklehead. And I saw him make a little note in his book. And but he gave me the dignity of my own higher power, and I'm glad that he did. And it was something tangible that I could see, that I could pray to, that I knew was bigger and more powerful than any human being, and especially since I was now being trained to not play God with my life and the lives of other people that fell under my influence, it was necessary. And somewhere along about 3.5 years of sobriety, as near as I can recollect now, it evolved into a God of love and compassion that was keeping an eye out for me and other crazy drunks and fools, whether we were tuned in or not. And The beauty of it is over the years I've been able to tune in a little more and a little deeper and a little better all the time. And I believe in prayer and I believe in meditation. And I've seen the results in other people's lives, you know. It's funny about that, you know, about alcoholism, about the concept of God and a higher power. You know, alcoholism, what is it? It's the X factor. You cross over an invisible line. It's a disease that's recognized by the AMA, but how do you know if you've got it, you know? And how do you know if you're an alcoholic or not? And I heard things early on in sobriety that cemented my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard a guy say one time that he wasn't sure if he, when he became an alcoholic, but maybe it was the day that he bought the funnel. And I thought, yeah, I know about the funnel, man. You know, you got to have a funnel because you buy those giant cheap bottles of vodka or wine and then you put it up in all those little bottles and then you hide them all over your pad, whatever that happens to be, or in some cases outdoors behind certain trees and bushes and knot holes. And, you know, and you can have them as long as you're not so drunk that you can't remember where you hid them, you know, and that's what the funnel is for. And I thought, yeah, I understand that. And I heard a lot of other funny things, too. And somebody said that once you're a pickle, you're never going to be a cucumber again. And I thought, yeah, I'm a pickle, man. I'm pickled, and I can't go back. I can't regroup. I cannot be a social drinker, as if I ever wanted to be. But even if I wanted to be, I can't go back to be a cucumber. You know, I'm a pickle. You know, it's like, and I'm in a pickle, you know. But I wasn't carrying a court card anymore, and little by little things were evolving. My sponsor wanted me to get a job, and I said, you know, you don't understand, jobs are for chumps. I mean, people like me, we live off the fat of the land because we're smarter than the average chimp or chump. He said, no. He said, you know, those days are gone. You're not going to do that stuff anymore. We've been living on disability and living in jails and hospitals and detoxes and rehabs, and now it's time for you to stand up on your hind legs. And he had me get a job, and I got a job tarring a roof, and I got more tar on me than on the roof, but I got paid in American dollars, and I used my real name and real social security number because I was working with a guy who was a sober alcoholic, and he knew me. And actually, when I had 50 days, I took him to a meeting because I needed a ride, not because, my sponsor made me get rid of the car I had because I had no valid driver's license and no insurance on the car and no registration. No big deal. I had the key. I mean, he said, you're not driving till you're legal. That took a while. I had to go before a board of the California Highway Patrol with a tape recorder and five people sitting there because... I had this little record of having done shenanigans with cars before, and they wanted to never give me a driver's license again, ever. It was suspended for indefinite to life, you know, whichever comes first. But I did get my driver's license back, and things started to change. I got a job painting hallways in an apartment building. I'm not a good painter. I got the axe after 3 days because I could not apply paint to a wall. And at that point, the prognosis was not good, you know. The guy can't put paint on a wall with the roller when he's got the paint and the roller pan and the ladder right there. But I found something I could do, and some guys from my home group came up to me and said, listen, we think you've got the old Blarney in you there, and we're going to introduce you to our sales manager. Bring your resume. I had typed up my brutally honest resume sometime before, and I took it into this guy's... Brutally honest means on the front page, actual education and experience. Page two is all of the detoxes, nut house, rehabs, all of that. Kept me from getting health insurance for about a decade, but... Anyway, I took it in and I threw it on this guy's desk and I said, I'm here to sell you me. Don't read page two. It's a history of alcohol and drug abuse. I know you sell something here. I don't know what it is, but I bet I can sell it because I can sell anything to anybody. And he gave me this real squinty-eyed look and he said, you know, guys like you, you got more balls than brains. And he said, you're exactly what we're looking for. There's your desk right over there. Go get 'em, Tiger. And... And I've had a variety of ups and downs, but you know, the thing is, the fear of trying is gone away, and the fear of life itself. I can walk down any street in Los Angeles and feel like I'm not taking up too much space. You know, I feel like I'm getting to be the person that I was meant to be. In a lot of ways, I feel like my life is beginning in a way that that is totally positive and much better than it was when I was 15 years sober. If somebody would have told me when I was 15 years sober what I would do in the next 8 years, I wouldn't have believed them. I would have said it's too extravagant. It's too much. But you know, I guess I'm 23 years on the pink cloud of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just it goes on. And it's it broadens and deepens, and I'm a lucky guy. I, you know, I made amends to my family as much as I could. Like I told you, I had this aunt who wouldn't allow me on her property for about 3 years. But eventually, when the fires in Los Angeles were coming through the area of Brentwood where she lived, she called me up and said, "Do you think you can get up on the roof and man a hose?" And I said, "I'm the guy for the job. I'll be right there." And we started a little healing right then. And my father, when he retired, he was always an extraordinary person in my life. You know, I think for all male human beings, your father is your basic role model. And my father was a great guy. He was a big, loud guy, it seemed to me, but when he got old, I was this much taller than he was, and he gave us a lot. I never remember him having the sniffles or the flu or taking a day off of work, and we always lived in a nice house, and we always had food on the table, and we had nice things, and we had two cars and all of that stuff. But he passed away in 1998, and a couple of months before he died, he had been drinking a little bit more and a little bit more after he retired, and he was consistently alienating the people of his generation, and even my younger brother and sister didn't want to have anything to do with him anymore, because he would verbally beat you up when you'd call him. And I started calling him, and I figured out the best day for me to call him was on Sundays after the golf tournaments ended, because then we would have something to talk about. But he would try to set up roadblocks, and he would save the stumper questions from Jeopardy and make me answer them before he would have a conversation. So I started cheating. Memorizing the questions from Jeopardy when at 7 o'clock every weeknight, and so I'd know the answers, and it was a little game we played, and then we could talk about things that were safe for us to talk about, and then we could go off into other areas. And we talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about practicing the principles of the program and living the principles of the program. And one of the principles is love, and one of the principles is perseverance. And I wasn't going to let my dad's crusty behavior stop me from persevering, you know, because he was my dad. And, you know, when I was a teenager and I was running in a qualifying meet with 250 other kids from all the local high schools to go to the state meet, you had to finish in I guess the top 15 to go to the state meet, maybe the top 20. But I'm running along, and I don't know that he's even there, and then I hear about a quarter mile to go, and there's a straightaway, and everybody's doing their best to get there in the top 20, and I hear my name being hollered by somebody, and I glance over and past the ropes where some people are standing and the spectators are standing. I see my dad wearing a white shirt and a tie running along in his wingtips, hollering my name and saying, "Come on, go, you gotta go." And then he ran all the way to the finish line with me. And, you know, this was, you know, an astonishing thing. That's the kind of person he was. And he was a vice president and general manager of a large manufacturing company that they didn't measure things in square feet. They measured things in how many acres behind fence and how many acres under roof. And he was that kind of a blustery character. And Sharon met him before he about a year before he passed away. And the last conversation we had, he said, you know, I didn't think he was going to die. I don't think he did either. And he said, you know, I've really narrowed it down to a very few people that I really talk to anymore. And he said, you're probably my best friend in the whole world. And, you know, that's a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. It really has little to do with me as, you know, as one person and relating to another person. Of course, that's what it's about, but it's a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I wouldn't have done that if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Even if I was, you know, somehow magically transformed into a sober person, which is unlikely, without Alcoholics Anonymous, why would I have done that? It was because I needed to make amends, and I knew that there was somebody else that I cared about who was an alcoholic or might be an alcoholic, and just because they were in their disease was not going to repel me. You know, it wasn't going to get me to give up. And I'm sure that practically everybody in this room knows of somebody who is a hopeless, helpless alcoholic. And the kind of person that comes in and out of AA, well, you know what? Those people are often magically transformed for reasons that are well beyond our understanding. And my suggestion is don't give up on those people. Because what we have is what works. You know, we know what works and we know what doesn't work. And we can relate to each other in a way that non-alcoholics don't understand. Because we've all been there. We've all been there in our own way. And, you know, you didn't have to hang out on the Sunset Strip and, you know, party with Hendrix, you know what I mean? You know, you understand where I was and why I was there. Because I had to have that next drink, and I had to have fresh alcohol in my system no matter what time of day or night it was. And, you know, I'm grateful for every day of the 23 and a half years I have. Some years ago, Sharon mentioned to me, you did all this running. Did you ever win any letters? And I said, well, yeah, I did win some letters, but, you know, I don't have them now. And when my mother had passed away while I was still drinking, my sister and sister-in-law found some high school letters that I had. But she said, did you ever get one from Penn State? And I said, yeah, but I never went and collected it because even then it seemed a little juvenile. Why would I want it now? And she said, I don't know, might be a nice thing for you to have. And I thought nothing more of it. And a guy who actually graduated from Penn State came up to me and handed me a brochure and had a bunch of Nittany Lion souvenir stuff in it. And I said, what's this for? And he said, why don't you call this number and ask him about that letter? And I said, oh, that letter. And so eventually, sometime later, I called up that number and it was rec hall at Penn State, and they said, the guy I talked to said, listen, I don't have anything to do with that, but I'll patch you through in a minute, but I got to warn you in advance, they don't give out letters anymore. They haven't given out letters in years. They give out Nittany Lion patches for seniors. They give out windbreakers for juniors. They give out stadium blankets. They all have that logo on it, and no more letters, though. And they said, hold on a minute, and he punched me through to somebody else that was an assistant track coach, and then I wound up speaking with the assistant athletic director because the athletic director wasn't there that day. And it was a woman, and she said, I think I've been waiting for you to call. And I said, I don't understand. And the little hairs on the back of my neck started to go up, and she said, you know, I've been here for 27 years, and I have not seen a letter in about 15 years when we stopped giving them. And but I walked into my office this morning, and there was an 8-inch chenille Block S letter on my desk, and I have no idea where it came from, and I had no idea what I was supposed to do with it until right now, because somebody just told me on the phone before they passed you through why you're calling. And she said, congratulations. You're going to be the last person to receive a letter from the Pennsylvania State University. Before we got off the phone, she said, by the way, do a lot of little miracles happen in your life? I said, as a matter of fact, yeah, pretty often. So a few days later, I got the letter, and there was a typewritten letter there that I still have that says I'm going to be the last person ever to get a letter from the Pennsylvania State University and enjoy it. And that Christmas, I got a brand new letter jacket from Penn State, which I got the letter sewn on. Sharon gave me this beautiful jacket, and I don't wear it very often. It's a little warm for California, but I'm a 62-year-old guy with a brand new Penn State letter jacket, just in case. And I don't know what it means. I don't know what it's all about. I just know that if you hang around here, things will happen for which there is little or no rational explanation, and there are little God shots that happen along the line. And I told you about some of the things that have happened for me, and you're going to find out the things that are supposed to happen for you. But if you leave, you don't get to find out what those things are. And you won't even know until they're happening, until you're right in the middle of it. And then it all hits you. You know, that's when you get those glimpses of a higher power. You know, my concept of a higher power and my understanding of it is like seeing the wind affecting the trees outside. I can't see the wind, but I can see the effect of it blowing the palm fronds right outside the window there. And I see the effect of a higher power in the lives of the people around me in the same way that I see the effect of the wind. I don't see a higher power. I don't hear voices. But I see the effect in the lives of the people around me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths, it's the easiest thing you'll ever do, and it's the best. Thanks a lot for listening.